Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Poet Runner, hosted by Richard Modiana, and we'll be talking to Peter Wartzman today, and here you go, Richard.
Well, we're going to be talking to Peter Wartzman about his new book, Borrowed Words, Cut-Up Poems. And my first question, Peter, is what is the genesis of this book?
The genesis is directly related to the COVID period. I hunkered down for months and months in my studio. I'm calling you from New York on the East Coast, feeling cut off from the world. I'm accustomed to, my wife is French, we're in Europe often, but I just felt cut off from the world. And somehow the writing came fairly easily, and I was writing various forms. I write plays and fiction and all sorts of things. And then something happened, and I was unable to compose sentences anymore. I can't tell you why. And as a sort of self-therapy, a game, a kind of poetic solitaire, I started cutting up words out of the newspaper and various other places and pasting them onto paper. It's as a game, as a method. This had been developed by the Dada poet Tristan Tzara in the wake of World War I. I think to evoke the sense of a fractured society. And somehow what started out as a game for me, I soon realized these really were poems. And initially I didn't think I was ever going to publish them. And so initially I was sort of sloppy with the glue and there were a lot of splotches. And then I started taking greater care because it became apparent to me that this was as much a visual statement as an auditory statement. So that's how it all started.
And listeners, listeners, when you do buy this book, you are going to buy it by the end of this interview, you will want to read this book. I guarantee that. In the book are the original manuscripts, the cut-up manuscripts, the words pasted on sheets of lined paper, followed by a transcription of them. So this book has a visual element to it. That is really fascinating. But go ahead, Peter. I interrupted.
Thanks. So I also thought that I should present it. Initially, I was not going to present the originals. And then it was my wife and my brother, my best advisors, who thought, no, do put it down. And then I realized it's a little bit like when you read the works of a great foreign poet in translation, how the original is on the left-hand side of the page, and a transcript or the translation is on the right. And so I decided that was the perfect format, and that's the way it came together.
Well, it looks wonderful. It's really interesting to compare the two, and of course, it's fun actually for me to see the original manuscript with the line paper and the cut up phrases and single words, and I really like that.
And the transcript, so to speak, or the transliteration, is different from the original. That is, I decided in the transcribed version to be more precise about questions of punctuation and spacing as such. So they're not exactly the same. One is really the translation of the other. Yeah.
Well, to give an idea of what we are talking about listeners, I'm going to ask Peter to read both the original and the transcribed version. And let's start with. Let me see. I found one that I really liked here. Oh, where is that? Yeah, the way words look on the page.
Let's see. It's
on page 1415.
So if I read it aloud, you won't hear the difference between the original version and the transcribed version. I mean, we could discuss the changes that I made. But
yeah, sure. Okay, let's do that.
So I'm just going to read it aloud, and then I can, you know, clarify. The way the words look on the page, a piece of crumpled parchment, a floating blip, aloof, disinterested, bonsai body language, the same dreaming finger, letters do not lie awake, signs still seeking secrets. I think I've discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls.
That's wonderful how that all came together. And listeners, when you look at the first version, the title, "The Way the Words Look on the Page," that in the actual cut-up, this is the title of the poem, but there are no caps for these. But in the transcribed version, there are caps that indicate that it's a title. So that is one of the interesting differences. And of course, when you read the transcribed version, you can see the lines are staggered to the right of the page. And when you look at the original artwork version, let's say, because they do work as word art, and there is a lot of
that's
word
that,
art.
That pleases me to hear that.
When I was director of Beyond Baroque, we did have shows that were built entirely around word art. So in our gallery, the Mike Kelly Gallery. But yeah, it's and then, for example, the line "I think I've discovered" is all in caps, bold caps, and in the transcribed version, it is written as a regular sentence or fragment of a sentence. And just exactly how did this poem come together with the terrific ending, "I think I've discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls"?
Well, you know, it all. Random is the wrong word and chance is the wrong word, because it involved going into fairly deep concentration. I start by cutting out words. Then something happens. There's a psychic magnet inside that's pulling different words together, and over hours this somehow materializes in this form. I should point out that I am also a translator from the German, so the TypeScript version really does feel like a translation, in which I seek to crystallize and clarify anything that might not have been precise in the original. On the other hand, I like elements of the sloppiness or the lack of precision of the original. It somehow shows the process coming about.
Yeah,
in
that's
most
right.
Cases,
that's, well, that's the process. That is something that I really like. And I've interviewed bilingual poets on this show a lot, and one of the things that, and I've said this before, one of the advantages, as far as I'm concerned, that a bilingual poet has is you have two different, you have knowledge of two different languages, and to me, this knowledge of two different languages, one language illuminates the other language. It's sort of an entree into the whole universe of language as such, and because you see how I presume you were born a native speaker of English, correct? Or did you grow up
a little bit? It's a little bit more complicated. I'm the child of refugees from Vienna, so I grew up with German as my native tongue, but I never studied German in school. So I was born here. I was born in New York. So I really have two native tongues, and then to which later in life French is added. So I live my life pretty much in three languages these days.
Well, by the way, that was my father's case too. He grew up speaking Ladino, which is also known as Judeo-Spanish, and English at the same time. So he had that going for him when he was as a young adult. And then, of course, he learned standard Spanish fairly easily, because going from Ladino to regular Spanish was not that hard. But, yeah, so to all of my the point that I'm trying to make here is that all of these languages bring out something that may not be seen by a monolingual speaker. That's what I was trying to say.
Yes, I agree completely. And by the way, there are beautiful songs in Ladino. I don't know if you know the musical tradition. It's really gorgeous stuff.
I know that. Well, another one that I like is It Doesn't Disturb the Dead, which was on, let me see. It Doesn't Disturb the Dead at All on page 19.
Okay. Got it. It Doesn't Disturb the Dead at All. Sometimes the dancers hide their eyes. Sometimes they stop their ears. Sometimes they utter silent screams, soundless laughter. Last week, the Pope startled several thousand listeners gathered for his weekly audience by insisting that angels exist, which are unseen, the Pope said. They play like robots. You never know what they're thinking, but we play with heart. It's a perfect hybrid, like shamanistic medieval tricksters. I've never believed in eternity, but I'm beginning to have my doubts.
And that's another great ending. And all the poems have come together so beautifully for me, and that is one of the strengths of this book, listeners. It's really a fascinating book to read, and it is the kind of it's a work that bears rereading. You will really get into this, and especially the ability to compare the actual cut up page with the cleaned up transcription, so to speak. And that's something I really loved about it. Now, what I wanted to ask specifically was, what particular text did you pick to cut up? I mean, was it like papers or any random text that you came across?
It started just with the newspaper, and then I went wild, and I started cutting up sacred texts and sacred and profane. I wanted to mix sacred and profane. So I just cut up anything that came to hand. I should point out that over the years I've developed various methods of what I call ego busting. Sometimes for me that involves writing the initial draft in German or French and then adapting it into English. What that does, and the cut up was another, turned out to be another version of that. What that does is keep me from being either too self-conscious or sentimental. What the strangest thing is, the voice that comes out is my voice, but it's as if it's my voice on a recording played back to me. There's just something about I'm always getting stuck in my writing and always developing or trying to develop ways to get unstuck, and this is my current one, cut ups.
Yeah, well, you succeeded beautifully with this. Now, my next question is: can you walk us through the process, sort of like from soup to nuts? Like, you have selected the text. Then what do you do next?
So, Step one, go out and buy the newspaper, which is not easy to do nowadays because there are very few places. Their newsstands don't exist anymore. You know,
yeah.
Everything's electronic. So I have my source material. There are piles and piles of stuff. I cut up words, and something happens. I can't tell you what it is. I can tell you when it doesn't happen, and it's very painful. That is, I just sit in front of it and think I'm an idiot wasting my time in self-indulgence. But sometimes something happens. It's like a magnet inside that pulls words together. I can't describe it. I can't put it any other way. And when that happens, it's a glorious feeling. It isn't about me. It's something that's taken over, that's dominating my will, and then the poem comes out of it. And usually the last thing is I'll cut out a date and put it down as a stamp just to show this was really composed at a specific moment in time. It's always been important for me to note that.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that, listeners. Yes, each poem is dated at the end. Yes, and the one that Peter just read, It Doesn't Disturb the Dead at All, is dated February 19th, 2021. So, yeah, so it is in a way like more so with visual artists who proceed with a sort of an idea, and then it's a sort of an application of their intelligence and their intuition in assembling their painting or sculpture or collage, and it sort of reveals it to themselves. Some of the artists that I've talked to, well, just the other day I was seeing my friend Bob Brannaman, who is primarily a painter, but he also makes assemblages, which for our listeners who don't know that, assemblages are made up of different objects, different manufactured objects, not manufactured by the artist, but ordinary household goods and so forth, that he takes apart and rearranges in a new artistic way, for want of a better word. So there is a certain combination. There's a work, intuition and intelligence are at work. And the play, as Peter just said, it's very hard to describe the dialectic between these two things. You know, you have to do it in order to know what it is, because this is one of the limits of language. There are certain things that escape being described with language, and you just have to go with an intuition, and you sort of come out with something new. And in this connection, I forget who said it. I think it was an Asian poet who was talking about classical East Asian prosody, and he said that something like, there are poets who see the world through the prism of language, and then there are poets who see the world without any language and try to bring that seeing into language. So it's something like that is happening here, based on what you've said.
I should say that one of the influences, in fact, I was in Japan some years ago, and very much inspired by the monks drawing seemingly haphazard, but not haphazard designs in the sand in the dry garden in Kyoto.
Yeah.
And
the rock garden in Ryuanji. Yeah.
Yes. It's really in part an inspiration for this. That's the thought that I can do that. That one can do that with words. And I encourage listeners to try to play in the same way. It's just a lot of fun. But you got to let go. You have to let go completely. And you have to let it tell you where it wants to go. I don't, you know, in answer to an earlier question of yours, Richard, I don't start with a preconceived notion or idea. It tells me where it wants to go. But that's always been my same attitude to sentences in general, to the prose that I write. I prefer pretty brief prose. I guess my first book, A Modern Way to Die, was essentially flash fiction before flash fiction had a name. I wrote it back in the 80s. And there, too, I let the sentence tell me which way it wants to go. I don't tell it.
Yeah, well, that's something that... I was just watching a marvelous French TV series called The Adventurers of Modern Art, and they had an episode on Dada and Surrealism, and one of the things that, I forget which poet it was, but he said that he just looked at the blank paper until something came to him, and he started writing, and then it went on from there. And I've known other poets who start writing and maybe breaking their poems down into stanzas, and maybe by the third stanza they get into the flow, and when they finish their poem and they go back and look at it, they cut out those first two stanzas where they were basically noodling and sort of charging up for what was to finally become the actual poem itself. So I was wondering, did that play any role in your process, that sort of way of doing things?
I want to underline the first thing. I believe that in literature there are no rules. So anything that I say is merely a consequence, a result of the game that I'm playing. But everybody can play their own game according to their own set of rules. It is true. What started happening over time is that first the words would be cut out. Then I would put what seemed to be kindred words in various envelopes and start writing various orderings of the words on those envelopes until the envelopes or the outside became almost illegible. And that seemed to be about the time when it was ready to burst out into a poem.
Well, apropos of that, another poem is Where the Silence Is on page 23. And this sort of is a perfect illustration of what you were just saying.
Where the Silence Is. Something about the quiet, the trance-like indiscriminate, trying to find words for things there aren't words for, like budding flowers awakening.
Yeah, that's, this is listeners, this is a short poem, but it is full of, it's really packed with all kinds of allusions and meanings, for me at any rate, and especially that final line, like budding flowers awakening. And, of course, that is a budding flowers awakening is an organic process that happens according to some internal genetic coding, as far as we know. And, again, which is something that is hard to explain or maybe is altogether unexplainable. But this was, I think this, there are even lessons to be learned about the process of creation in this book, which is another thing that I liked about it. And this is one of the poems that addresses that for me. So
well, that pleases me to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are so many good poems. I'm going to let you pick one that you would like to share with the listeners, Peter.
Let me see. Makes a lot of favorites in this one. Nocturne. O shepherd of dreams, wanderer of the night, assemblage, shape, nimble time, in the forest of darkness, teach us the density of meaning, quilts beyond language, wild longing, the blurry lines in between. That's one of those that the reader might detect. There are elements cut out of sacred text. Or,
mm-hmm.
I mean,
yes,
I don't.
Yes.
But for me, there are no sacred texts. But I mean, let's say, in this case, it's the Bible that I put together with advertising copy and just all sorts of things.
And that is, this is. Yeah, I mean, again, this was like there's a skill involved in making the selection. And, again, this is something that just anybody could try this. But, again, you will have to have a certain skill. And, of course, it doesn't come – nobody is born with this except for maybe a few geniuses. So it is something that you learn. And maybe people like Peter who are bilingual have a certain advantage over others who are not because they have a particular special interest or insight into the way language works. I mean, even intuitively, because when you're a kid and you're doing what they call code switching in linguistics, that's their technical name about going back and forth between two languages that you know. And, of course, there are all kinds of theories of language acquisition and so forth. And there are various debates, at least on the scientific level. But on the actual practical level, on the artistic level, for somebody that is a poet, somebody that works with words, it happens on a different level. I mean, you know, some artists do, of course, approach their art as though it were science, but it's something that Man Ray said I thought was really apropos. He said that there is no progress in art because somebody said that he had raised the art of photography to a new level, or photography had progressed under the hand of Man Ray. But his answer was, there is no progress in art. There are only different ways of doing it.
Yeah. Can I read you another one that basically addresses, in a sense, the playfulness of it all? And I really underline, when I say play, it doesn't mean something non-serious. It doesn't mean, if you watch a child at play, they're very, very serious. I had the delight, for a job for years, I interviewed famous physicians to write profiles about them. And one Nobel laureate, I took the liberty of starting with a quote from the Dutch sociologist Huizinga about the nature of play. And I asked him, does he play? And he said, he smiled and he said, I haven't worked a day in my life. I've only been playing. This is a text called Poetry. I didn't sit down to write a poem. There's so much to be mined. Love, vengeance, madness, prophecy, secrets and lies. Sound bellowing from someone's throat. I'm not going to dwell on stuff that's going to break my heart. At the end of the day, all you have to do is lie artfully. You can do this. Keep going.
Yeah, that's, I'm really amazed at how these poems come together in the final line. And of course, one of the things that I like about the poems in this book is there is surprise in them. You cannot predict where you were going. You start out with the opening lines, and you don't know where exactly it's going to end, which is, you know, some poems you can tell about more or less. Oh, yeah, this is how I can more or less see what's coming up. In these poems, you really can't, and it's a surprise, and I like that surprise, because that in itself is something that is absorbing to a reader. That is something that, I mean, even after you've read the text for the first time, you will want to come back to it. You say, I know how it's going to end now, but still, going through it again, it reveals more of itself, and to me, you know, good poetry has that. Good poetry bears up against going back to it again and again. You will probably come across some poems that are favorites of yours, and one of the ones that I really enjoyed was Dream Song, which is on page 29. And I wonder if you could let us hear that one, Peter.
29. Dream Song. New York, the echoing skyline, broken stalagmites, traces of fire and burned bones, a potential future archaeological find, even more ephemeral than actual ephemera. Watching the rain fall on the empty streets, tears talking, the pretext, not the point, overshadowed by mind. I don't exist. Wouldn't it be nice if we could all wake up now?
Yeah, this, well,
now,
one of the
I should
things
say
that I like,
that,
go ahead.
Can I say,
yeah,
in retrospect, when I look at this poem, I realize it harkens back to 9/11, which I saw happen outside my window.
Exactly.
I saw the buildings go down. We live downtown. And so it was you must imagine, it's as if there's the Rocky Mountains one morning outside your window, and the next day the Rocky Mountains are down.
And that was evident to me. I mean, I lived in New York for many years before moving out to Los Angeles, and that was, and in fact, the building where I used to live, when this happened, I called a friend of mine who lived across the hall, and he described the scene to me from the window that we could both see. And when I was there, my apartment was next to his, and we both had that same view. But that was exactly my first thought when I read this poem, but there is so much other, there for me, there were so many other illusory things in this, like, I don't exist, wouldn't it be nice if we could all wake up now? that suggested to me, and this may sound exotic to you and other people, but I thought of Chuang Tzu's famous, am I a butterfly dreaming I'm a man, or am I a man dreaming I'm a butterfly? And wouldn't it be nice if we could all wake up now? And we are just about out of time, Peter. I would love to go through this with you more, but we have to move on. But anyway, this book is it's a terrific read. It's a short book, and it bears rereading. And it also has a wonderful visual aspect because we get to see the actual original text, the actual cut-ups themselves. And I urge you to buy this book, Borrowed Words, Cut-Up Poems by Peter Wertzmann from Bamboo Dart Press. And listeners, order it from the publisher Bamboo Dart Press. Google it on, you put it in your search engine, and it'll come up. And I emphasize this because it is important to support small presses because these are the ones that are taking all the risks. This is where you're going to find really original and interesting work coming from a small press like Bamboo Dart Press. I mean, they take the chances because they can afford to. And it's really, they're absolutely necessary to have. Otherwise, we are going to end up with Nick Poetry or something worse. Or get it from your local independent bookstore. And if these two sources don't work, well, you can go to Amazon and get it there. But please go to Bamboo Dart Press first. And we've been talking to Peter Wertzmann. The book is Borrowed Words, Cut-Up Poems. Peter, thank you for your time, and it has been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much, Richard. It's a great pleasure. I feel as if you're sitting there in front of me. I don't see you, but I hope we'll see each other again sometime soon. And thank you very much.
Oh, you're
thank
welcome.
Thank you, Raphael.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
So now we come to the second half of the poet right now. We have Jason Warsumo. How are you?
Hi, how are you doing today? How are you today?
I'm good. Did you run today?
I did. I ran today. I ran 20 laps today. Easy. I just did a race a couple of days ago, Sunday, in Doc Lawler. It's a 5K race. It's a Leslie Cohen 310 5K race.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I did a speed run today, and I'm trying to get back down to, like, 5 miles and 39 minutes, and I'm stuck at 5 miles and 40 minutes.
Oh, you'll get there. You're the best. You'll get there. You're wonderful every day. You're the best.
No, I don't know how weight figures into it, but I sometimes think that I've gained weight. Even though I run so much, I'm still gaining weight. It's like, how does that work? Because appetite, everything changes when your metabolism changes from the running. But it's like, yeah, it's a different experience now that I'm heavier than I've ever been for running. Because I usually run at 140, and I'm about 149 right now. I'm kind of, getting used to that.
Okay.
But what race do you have coming up? And I see you're always running in groups, which is something that I haven't been able to get to yet. And you always have a good support team with you when you're running.
Yes, I do. I have a support team. Thank you very much. It's called LA Roadrunners. I'm a pace leader for LA Roadrunners, and I'm an ambassador for Los Angeles Marathon. So I can give you a discount.
Oh, wow. I think I could use that, actually, because I still haven't gotten it yet. But, do you just pace for the LA Marathon, or do you pace for other races?
Well, I'm a pacer for training runs, but they haven't had me pace in a race because you have to hold a stick. Because I weigh 143 pounds. And last year I weighed 149 pounds, so I lost weight. And I don't know, but we'll see. Maybe they want me to pace in a race, or maybe not. I don't know. But I'm still pacing without holding the sign.
Yeah, that just seems like eventually it'll wear on you. I mean, it's not sight as much, but you know, constantly holding this, you're running 26 miles. It's got to be a lot. I mean, part of it right now. It's got to wear on you a little bit.
Yes, it is going to. That's true. I have to agree with you on that.
No, I've seen Pacers. I've seen them Pacers all the time, and I spotted them, and I see them holding this sign, and it's like, damn, it's got to eventually start hurting.
Yes.
Do you have any races coming up, and are you training for anything, or are you, how many races do you do a year?
How many races do I do a year?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I do between 20 to 45.
Damn. You got me beat. I think I only got 20 this year. Yeah, I'm pretty
Let
sure
me tell you something.
Like
there was a... Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. Okay. Well, there was a year where I did like a few races, like maybe 5 to 10 races.
Mm-hmm.
There was another year that I just only did like 4, like less than 10 races before. I did that before. But it feels great when you run a race because you can get ready
mm-hmm.
for any race in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good to have medals because you use them as, that's our art. Medals are art. Running races is art. You're an artist. You're creating something.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I don't know. I've been trying to get to the ultra level. I did one 31-mile race, I believe, about 2 months ago. And that was interesting.
Okay.
I mean, what's the most miles you ran? What's the most miles you've done in a race? I mean, what do you want from the races? Do you want to do marathons, ultras, or do you just want to... 5Ks and marathons, or is there a goal?
You know what? I would love to do an ultra marathon. I thought about it once, and I was like, nah, it's not going to work for me. But I want to do one in the future. Maybe as I, you know, I don't know, maybe in my 50s or in my 60s or in my 70s, I'll do an ultra marathon. But right now, I... do 5Ks, 10Ks, 15Ks, half marathons, and full marathons.
That'll keep you busy. You mentioned the book you wanted to talk about, something you wrote.
Yes, I want to talk about the book, yes. Something that I did, yes. It's called Track and Field Practice in Races. It can help all the runners all over the world. It can help everybody all over the world. Like, let's say that you're running to a movie theater or something. Let's say that you're going to run to go see X-Men, the movie. Well, I'm going to run to it. You could log it in, right? Let's say you're running 3 miles to the movie theater, AMC or Regal or something. And then you run into it, and then you could just have the book with you. You have the book at home or wherever, and then you can log it in, like location, Beverly Hills, practice. Well, I ran 3 miles to Regal Theater to go see X-Men. Time, you don't have to time yourself. Well, you do, but you don't. Medal, you can say, I am the medal. You know, the reason why I wanted to do this book is to help everybody. I want to help all the runners. I want to help people all over the world. Walkers, this book is for walkers. This book is from ages 1 to future, to ages in their elementary school, their middle school students, high school students, college students, people in their late 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 100s, and 110s and furthermore.
Cool. That sounds good. I mean, this. I mean, I should really start logging my runs because you know, just to know how many miles you do a month, how many miles you do a week, and, you know, I mean, for one point, I was actually doing about 120 miles a week, but I haven't done that in a long time. How many miles do you average a week?
Well, I average from total of 23 to total of 40.
Yeah, a runner gave me the advice that I should do 10-mile run, then a 5-mile run, then a 10-mile run, then a 5-mile run. So my 10-mile run, I don't try to get a PR because I'm just trying to just keep training. But when I do the speed run, I'm always trying to beat the run because the 5-mile run is always trying to get it done by below 39 or 38 minutes. So I'm always pushing myself when I do the speed run more than I push myself on the distance, if that makes sense.
Well, you know, you're doing great. You're excellent. Let's say you're running a race. Let's say you have a race in December, like a marathon. Like, let's say you have Boston Marathon. It's in December this year. I know they have it in April all the time, but let's say they have Boston Marathon 2022. If you want to take it easy, if you just want to just run 5 days a week or 4 days a week or 3 days a week or 2 days a week, then you can do that. If you want to do that, if you just want to run, well, I want to run 2 days a week, every week, then you can do that. You can do that. It's just, it's going to help you. It's going to help everybody if they run 2 days a week or 3 days a week or 4 days a week or 5 days a week or 6 days a week. Well, how about if they run every day? Every day.
Yeah.
Then they can help.
That would be me.
They can run a race. They could, you know, it's great. You know, it's the same thing to me. You just got to figure out a way how I can do it without injuring myself. You know, you got to train smart.
Yeah.
Well,
when my knees hurt, I got the compression things to put around my knees. I even got something for my my quads if they start hurting. I'm very careful when I run because I don't want. I always have a race coming up. I've got the No Name Ultra coming up in December. I don't want to be ready for that. And I got the Dias de los Muertos 5K coming up this Saturday. And I just try to keep myself busy up front, so I'm always running. And I don't know if it's for you, but I enjoy the zen-like feeling I get from just running.
Uh-huh. I understand. I understand. Yes, I understand.
I think running is the only thing that comes close to being high, you know, without drugs.
Right. I understand that. Let's say that Boston Marathon is on December 2nd, and let's just say it's November, like November 25th or 26th right now. It's okay. You could run 2 days. You could run 3 days. You could run 4 days. You could run 5 days. You could run 6 days, 7 days. Like, let's say this is December 1st. The Boston Marathon is tomorrow. So you got to, like, run between 1 mile, 2 miles, or 3 miles. That's it, because you don't want to, you know, injure yourself. So if it's race day tomorrow, like Boston Marathon or half marathon or 5K, 10Ks, and 15Ks, then you should run like mile one, mile two, or mile three. 3 miles, and that's it, because you don't want to injure yourself on race day, and you can't do the race.
Just tapering off too, you know, like before a marathon, just taper off and run, but don't overtrain. I've seen what overtraining does. I've actually overtrained, so, and hurt myself.
I'm sorry to hear that. I think you should just be careful, and you just kind of have to, it's like, you have to figure it out. How can I get a great time? How can I train right and not the wrong way? How can I do that? So you just got to take it slow, and then, you know, like let's say you need a plan, a training plan. That goes for everybody. That goes for runners all over the world and for walkers and for everybody. Now, let's say you have 4 days a week. Yeah, go ahead, Jeff, say.
No, I mean, go ahead. I can get back to my idea after I talk.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Let's say that you have a training plan for 5 days a week. You run 5 days a week. Well, you're getting ready for, like, let's pick a marathon. How about San Francisco Marathon? Yeah, I did that before. It was beautiful. San Francisco Marathon is in January. Now, let's say this week, you take it easy this week. Monday, 3 miles. Tuesday, 3 miles. Wednesday, 3 miles. Thursday, 3 miles. And Friday, you can run 2 miles. The second week, you go up, you go forward, you run mile 4 5 days a week. Sooner, like after 13 or 14 weeks, you're going to start running long runs because the marathon is getting close. You're going to have to start running long runs in December because you have the San Francisco Marathon in January of 2023. I'm just saying, it's just for example. San Francisco Marathon, who knows? Maybe they'll have it in January, but they always have it in the summer of July. You got to start running long runs when the marathon is near.
Huh. Most people, I know, taper off when the marathon's near and they do their long runs first, but you got a different approach.
Every runner has a different approach to train. We runners and walkers, not every runner has the same training approach. We are different. Our bodies are different. Our speed is different.
Yep.
We just got to, you know, figure out a way how to run a great race without injuring yourself, without getting sick. Without cramping.
Oh, yes. Long Beach Marathon, I saw somebody on the ground, and the firefighters came to get him, like, on the 20th mile. He was out.
Really?
He was just out. Yep.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
No, it happens. I think sometimes runners that do a marathon for the first time start too quickly. They don't pace themselves. They don't watch their speed. They don't, they don't know how to run it. And I think that guy might have been. I mean, I'm hoping he was a new guy, because if it's an old timer, it's gotta hurt to, like, you know, not make it up past the 20th mile. But yeah, I noticed that. I felt bad for the runner because he was down.
Oh. Yes, because. See, even when it rained, let's say that it rained on Marathon Day. I remember before I did marathons and before I did half marathons, I was watching the L.A. Marathon, and it was raining. It was raining. That was like 11 years ago, and it was raining. And then I thought to myself, you know what? I want to run a marathon. You know, let me run a marathon. So my first marathon was L.A. Marathon, 2012, at age 29. I just wanted to run so I can, you know, eat. eat donuts, eat cake, eat pretzels, eat Oreo cookies, eat cupcakes, you know, eat French fries, you know, drink orange juice, drink soda. Wait, I don't drink soda, so I'd rather not mess with that. But anyway, I want to do that. But here's the thing. I cramp in mile. And I think in mile 21, I cramped. It wasn't raining. It was kind of cold. I was wearing a blue, long blue shirt. I don't have that blue shirt no more. I gave it away. The yellow shorts, it just broke. It just got destroyed. The tights I was wearing, I don't know if I still have those tights. Probably not. I was laying down in Brentwood, all right, and I was cramping so badly. Because you want to know why I cramped so badly? Because I didn't drink enough water. It was very cold. I didn't train properly. He was my training plan for years ago, 11 years ago. I just took it easy. I just ran 3 days. That's it, you know, because I'm used to running 5 days a week, but I just ran 3 days. That's it. Most of the time, 2 days. And then I just ran easy. That's it. I didn't really do that much in running. And then I would just, you know, go to the movies and stuff, or, you know, hang out with my friends, you know. But I just ran 2 days, because I know when a marathon's coming up, if I train, I thought about this at the age of 29. I thought about, if I train a lot 7 days a week, I might injure myself in my first L.A. marathon at age 29. So I decided, let me take it easy. Let me run like 2 days a week, sometimes 3 days a week. But I did long runs. There was a training long run I did, because I started L.A. Roadrunners at the age of 28, going on 29. I ran a long run. I don't know how many miles. I think it was, we started from Venice, and we went all the way up. It was actually raining on that day. It was raining. And I ran. I had a gray hoodie jacket, and I had tights and shorts. And I was running. And then suddenly I finished, and I just started cramping. I cramped, and I hurt badly. And a good friend of mine, he's one of my best friends. He was a coach at L.A. Roadrunners. He said, "Are you okay?" I just started cramping. Oh, and then my good friend, Michael, he's not in L.A. Roadrunners no more. And they just started giving me Gatorade. I was drinking Gatorade. And then my cramp was gone. So that's what I need. I need to drink Gatorade and water right now. So I need to do that. I should have just, you know, had 12 bottles of water before the race, before the LA Marathon 2012, and kept on drinking, and that way I wouldn't cramp. I didn't have enough water in me back in L.A. Marathon 2012. You see, now in L.A. Marathon 2013, I pretend that I didn't know how to do an L.A. Marathon, so I did it easy. I took it easy. I ran easy. I started running easy. I ran easy. I kept running easy. And then in Brentwood, I cramped a little bit. I started cramping. Then I walked, and then I started, kept running. And then my time was in L.A. Marathon was 4:18 I got. For the LA Marathon 2012, I got 7:26. That was my time. I had to walk the rest. I kept walking in the LA Marathon 2012. It was just, boy. And then after that, after the end of LA Marathon 2012, in the year 2012, I was so sad. I was like, oh, boy, I was sad. I thought that I would have, like, 3 hours. That would take me 3 hours. Oh, boy. I was like, oh, man. I said to myself, look, listen, I don't know if I really want to do this again, but I decided I want to do it again. I'm going to try again. I'm going to pick myself up, forget about what happened in the LA Marathon 2012, and just move on. Get up and move on. Be strong. Be confident. Always move forward. My motto.
Yep.
Move it. Move it. Move it. You heard that song. Move it. Move it. Move it. So I did it. And another thing, too. My first half marathon was age 30. In January of 2013, the Los Angeles half marathon, they don't have it no more. I don't know why they don't have that half marathon no more. I think because, I don't know. But anyway, that was a good marathon. And my time was 1:29. That was my first time running the half marathon at age 30. Boy. So, yeah. So we are different. Runners are different. They got different bodies.
Yep.
Different minds, different training plans. Like I read the runner's book, and then they'll tell you how to train for a marathon, and they say 4 days a week you run. So, but we all have different training plans. For a marathon, for a half marathon, for a 5K, for a 10K, and for a 15K.
Yeah, every day to me is different. I mean, I always try to visualize the way I'm going to run just to make sure I get 5 to 10 miles, no more, no less sometimes. Sometimes after the speed run, I'll run an extra 4 miles, but a little slower pace. But yeah, we all do train differently. When I started was I was always trying to race other people when I saw them running, and I'd always get mad when they passed me. Then I realized, man, it doesn't matter. I just got to keep running and enjoy it.
Well, just enjoy every race, the 5K, 10K, 50K,
yeah.
Half marathon, full marathon, even if they pass you. When they pass me, I enjoy it more. Because it's fun to me. It's like free time. I have free time to run a race. I have free time. I have so much time to run a 5K, 10K, 15K, half marathon, full marathons. You know, you name it. There's food. There's oranges. There's pretzels. There's water. There's Gatorade. You know, I've taken advantage of it. I'm living it, you know. I'm having fun, you know.
That's all you can do.
I'm not thinking about nothing else. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here listening.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not thinking about nothing else when I run a race. Well, you know, you can think about something. You can think about art. You can think about music. You can think about, you know, traveling. You know, you can think about, you know, anything. You can think about, I don't know, potato chips. think about pizza. I'm going to eat pizza after I run a race, after I run a beautiful race. All beautiful races are great. They're all beautiful. They're all unique. It's an art. Every race is an art. It is. It's an art. You're an artist when you run a 5K or a 10K, a 15K, or a half marathon or a full marathon or an ultra marathon, you know. And you were asking about my what's my next race? Well, I'm doing Malibu 5K and Malibu half marathon.
I'm doing Malibu too. I'm doing that one.
We're half marathon or 5K?
Half marathon.
I'm doing the 5K. Oh, cool. Beautiful.
I got that one booked a while ago. I got the Big Bear Marathon, Los Muertos 5K, and I got the No Name Ultra. Those are my last races for this year.
Okay. All right. Oh. Perfect. Perfect. Well, when is Big Bear?
Big Bear, I believe, is November 12th.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely want to do that one. I like the idea of running. I like trail running more than I like running in the streets. I like running marathons, but I prefer to run, you know, in trails than I do in the even ultra. You know, even the Bulldog Ultra was almost killed me. It took me 8 hours to do it. I preferred it because it was like, you know, it was in a trail, it was in the mountains. You know, I prefer that to the cities. If that's me.
Okay, the trail runs are perfect. I like them, but not that much. I like running the marathons in the city and on the track. I mean, I like running on the hills. Yeah, hills are pretty good. They'll help you. You know, they will help you. They'll make you stronger. I mean, the track will make you stronger, too. It's the same thing, but I think the hills, something about the hills when you run, you get ready for San Francisco Marathon. You get ready for L.A. Marathon. You get ready for Hawaii. I never did Hawaii, but I want to do Hawaii. But, you know, I think they have hills in Hawaii, I believe, Hawaii Marathon. They usually do.
Somebody I know is doing the first Roman Marathon this year in March. That would be something. So I'm not going to see her at the LA Marathon because she'll be doing the Roman Marathon. They fall in the same
Roman?
Day. Yep.
What, Roman?
Yep, in Rome, the first Rome Marathon is happening this year.
Oh, really? Cool.
Yep. Yep. That should be interesting. I'm probably going to interview her after she runs it.
Oh, perfect. Brand new,
something different.
Really perfect.
I'm looking forward to hearing about it. Also, where can we get your book? Where can we purchase it?
On Amazon. There's a code. I sent you a code by email.
Yeah, could you tell our listeners the code so they could try to find it?
Yes, it's a code. I sent you the code by email.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's, okay, because I'm going to say it. Do you want me to say it? I could say the code.
Yeah, sure.
It's B. It's B0BB. K6TMWZ.
Cool. How long's your book been out?
Oh, it's been out like a couple months, I believe. Like maybe.
Cool.
It hasn't been that long. Like maybe late August, early September. It can help you. In a way, like if you finish the log in the book, you'll realize that you're progressing, realize you're doing great. You're still doing great while you're in the middle of the book or the first book. You're still doing great. In the end of the book, you're still doing great. There's a you can figure out, like, where your results are once you finish the book, when you log it in.
Mm-hmm.
You know? You can realize where you at right now. You know, it's even for walkers. Like, let's say that they just want to walk and they don't want to run. Well, I'm going to walk on a track. Like, I'm going to walk, like, for, like, maybe 1 hour. Let's say they're walking at a track in UCLA. Location, UCLA. Practice. I walk for 1 hour. Time. That's their choice if they want to time themselves or not. Medal. You can say, I am the medal. Or if you're running a race, let's say that you're running a 5K race, a Santa Monica Classic 5K. You run the 5K, you get like 17 minutes. Location, Santa Monica. The 5K race, you could write down Santa Monica Classic 5K. The time, 17 minutes. The medal, the Santa Monica Classic medal. You know? So it's for everybody all over the world. You know, they don't want to, what if they don't want to race? What if they want to keep, or they want to keep racing, or if they want to just practice and race, they can do that. It's up to them. It's up to the runners. The runners are their own coach. The walkers are their own coach. Everybody all over the world is their own coach. They're their own teacher. They're their own leader. They're the kings and queens. Everybody is the king and queen all over the world. This book can help you in life, too. It can help you be prepared to look for a job. It can help you be prepared to go to a store, to go to farmer's market for fruit. It can help you travel all over the world. You could run anywhere in the world. You could run anytime, morning, night, afternoon, midnight. I know some runners like to run in the mornings. I know some runners run in the afternoon. I know some runners run at night. I know some runners run at midnight. You know,
yep.
You can run anywhere, all over the world, at any time.
Yeah.
You know, it can also can help you with choices that you make. It can help you make positive choices on what you eat, what you do. It can really help you every minute in life. This is a beautiful book. It helped me a lot. It helped me figure out what to do. How many miles do I want to run? I'd rather just run 2 miles and then log it in. And also it can help me make this better decisions in life. So this book is a helper. It's a beautiful helper.
Oh, cool. We're running out of time. It's great having you on the show. We've been talking to Jason.
It's great having you, too. Yes.
And you'll be, I'll be probably see you at the Malibu Half Marathon. You know.
Yes, I'll see you there too. You can.
I'll probably be having pancakes afterwards, and you'll be doing a pizza.
Well, you know what?
Hey, it's been nice talking to you.
You know what? Nice talking
what?
To you, too. And thank you so much for everything.
Sure. You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Now I'm going to promote something that I've actually been using. I got the Shox headphones. They actually work great. I ran the Long Beach Marathon. They don't run out of time. I would actually, without a problem, suggest people buy them. They're great. They don't hurt the ears on you. They're not get earbuds. They hurt the ears sometimes. These are perfect. They're perfect for running. They're great for distance. And I highly recommend it. And please tune in again to Poet Runner. Our next show will be with Alicia Young on Friday, I believe at 4 p.m. Please tune in then. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.